This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
China is trading 4.5 times more with Africa than the U.S. is. And in issues like critical minerals, you know, U.S. companies are pretty much not on the continent.
That's Whitney Schindman, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution on U.S.-China trade involvement in Africa. Details coming up. Also, Great Britain is suspending most aid to Rwanda over an offensive by the M23 rebels in the eastern DRC. And two major aid agencies have stopped operations in the Zamzam refugee camp in North Darfur. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. South Africa's finance chiefs say they will make sure that debt relief for the continent tops the agenda at the meeting of G20 finance ministers and central bank governors that began in Cape Town yesterday. The G20, a group representing the world's top economy, says 54 lower-income countries, including 25 in Africa, are spending more on debt repayment than at any time in the last 3 decades. Darren Taylor reports.
Repaying billions of dollars to lending institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, and countries such as China and the United States means African nations can't spend much on essential public services. The United Nations and other organizations say Africans suffer as spending on health, education, climate change mitigation, and infrastructure is cut to service debt. Tembisa Fakude, director of the Africa-Asia Dialogues Group in Johannesburg, says poorer countries are forced to take loans at high interest rates because lending institutions consider them to be high risk. In Egypt, for example, the IMF estimates interest payments ate up more than 70% of government revenues in 2024. The figure is 25% for Angola, Ghana, Kenya, Malawi, and Nigeria. Fakude told VOA the Global South is facing the worst debt crisis in 30 years, and he doesn't think G20 deliberations will help much.
They've never been effective. Their commitments are not binding, and with Donald Trump coming in, being unpredictable, I'm not quite sure whether we are going to get what we expect to get. Most of that money that's going to be coming our way, it's not going to be free or grants. These are loans. We have to pay this money back. Most of the African countries are still struggling paying back the COVID loans that were granted to African countries. African countries, of course, are looking at South Africa, that South Africa might just twist some hands and certain things might happen, including the debt relief. But everybody else is talking about other important issues that are impacting the globe. They all have their own commitments. We are seeing the foreign policy positions of many European countries, including the United States, turning and looking inward.
Fakude says indebted African countries shouldn't expect any relief from the United States under President Donald Trump's administration. He says he expects the U.S. to demand that loans be paid in full. The U.S. Treasury Secretary is skipping the G20 finance ministers' meeting this week, as Washington's relations with South Africa have turned frosty. In addition, the top finance officials of Japan, India, Canada, and the European Union are also skipping the meeting. Business Unity South Africa President Busisiwe Mavuso says any discussions about debt relief will be difficult without positive input from the United States, the G20's biggest economy.
Is there something that these multilateral organizations like the G20 and the B20 can do as we move towards this multipolar environment where we are seeing the strong power and strong arm politics? the kind of tensions that you're seeing at the moment from a global perspective, we haven't seen such tensions till 1945. It therefore calls upon us as the business community, as the governments that are in these multilateral organizations to say, how are we going to actually put interventions in place that are going to ensure that we navigate this and our economies are not decimated.
The B20 is a collective of business leaders from G20 countries. Ideally, says Fakude, the G20 will decide on a new multilateral debt relief package that includes all creditors. Should the US exclude itself from that, he says, the G20 should move forward on rescuing poor countries from debt without input from Washington. The United Nations calculates that a reduction of 60% of the debt stock that burdens highly indebted countries will save the 31 poorest countries nearly $80 billion, enough to prevent them from defaulting on repayments. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Whitney Shindman is a non-resident senior fellow working on the Global Economy and Development Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution in Washington. In a recent article, he writes that without effective tools to support U.S. companies, the United States risks losing out commercially in the African market to China and the emerging middle powers. He talked with me about what the future holds for Africa with the U.S. and China.
With a very cloudy crystal ball and great humility, you know, I can venture a couple of thoughts. The situation now is when you look at U.S. trade versus Chinese trade, China is trading 4.5 times more with Africa than the U.S. is. And in issues like critical minerals, you know, U.S. companies are pretty much not on the continent. So I would say the U.S. is in a deficit position as it relates to the African market. And this has direct bearing with the tools that I mentioned in my piece. Number one, the African Growth and Opportunity Act has been the cornerstone of the U.S.-African commercial relationship for 25 years. Could it have done more? Yes. Should it do more? Yes. But we need it to be reauthorized just to provide that continuity of commercial ties. So that's number one. We can talk about what kind of modernization, but renewing AGOA, I would argue, is absolutely critical to our commercial engagement on the continent. Number two, in the dismantling of USAID, one of the instruments that was a casualty was Prosper Africa, which President Trump created the first time he was in the White House. So that's a little contradictory, the fact that you would have this initiative that Trump created that was pretty effective in advocating for U.S. Investment on the continent, now completely dismantled. So hopefully that gets reviewed and brought back once they do their 90-day review.
You're talking about Prosper Africa, and you're actually right that it created, in the first Trump administration, the initiative helped to close almost 1,852 deals valued at $86 billion over the last 4 years in 49 countries.
I wouldn't hazard a guess other than they've clearly taken like a sledgehammer to USAID and closed down virtually all operations. And Prosper Africa is very much a casualty of that sledgehammer approach to reviewing USAID. It makes no sense to me for an administration that, you know, wants to see America first. Well, America first, that means, you know, we have to be strong economically at home, but we also have to be strong economically globally, because the two are so interconnected.
AGOA, like you mentioned, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which is set to expire in September 2025. You also mentioned the Development Finance Corporation, DFC, set to expire on October 6th, 2025. So the question is there any bipartisan consensus to kind of sustain these organizations under the Trump administration?
Well, you know, that's probably the key point I try to make in the in my article, is that for the last 25 years there has been an enduring bipartisan consensus in Congress that the U.S. has interests in Africa worth investing in. And, you know, when AGOA was renewed in 2015 for 10 years, it passed the Senate with a vote of 99-1. That just underscores the strength of the bipartisanship that existed then. And I like to think it will emerge now. But I think we need a signal from the Trump administration that this is consistent with their American first objectives.
Whitney Shindman, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, he spoke with me here in Washington, D.C. Great Britain says it is suspending most direct bilateral aid to Rwanda over an offensive by the M23 group in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. United Nations experts say the offensive is supported by Rwandan soldiers, a charge Kigali denies. According to the French news agency AFP, a British government spokesman says the aid would be suspended until significant progress was made in reducing the fighting. The British Foreign Office also says London will suspend future defense training assistance to Rwanda and consult with partners on potential new sanctions. Rwanda responded by slamming the measures as punitive. A new study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies on the sustained fighting by militant Islamist groups in Africa indicates three theaters account for 98% of the deaths lined to such groups as the Sahel, Somalia, and the Lake Chad Basin. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the center and the author of the study, discussed the reasons behind the rise in these regions with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Well, I think it's important to underscore that, you know, the militant Islamist violence is concentrated in a couple of theaters. It isn't unfolding across the whole continent. But there's a combination of factors why these insurgencies persist in these theaters. The first is we're dealing with weak government that have not been able to sustain a security presence in the affected territories. And this has been exacerbated by the pushing out of the UN peacekeeping forces in the Sahel, as well as some of the regional forces that have been assisting. Plus, over time, these insurgent groups in each of the different theaters have become more organized, and they become better able to generate revenues, which have allowed them to sustain themselves, and they've grown more sophisticated. Al-Shabaab in Somalia, for example, is estimated to earn some $130 million a year in revenues. The JNIM coalition in the Sahel is estimated to bring in, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year. And so they're increasingly well-resourced and therefore more difficult to combat. And so I think in the process, we can also say that these militant Islamist groups are really acting more like organized criminal groups over time. And while they still invoke religion and grievances against the government as their motivation, the resource demand and the resource opportunities are also increasingly important in driving what we're seeing this. And as these groups have moved into more populated areas in the Sahel, for example, in the southern and central parts of the country, this is also a key reason for the fatalities we're seeing. I think it's important to be clear that the governments of these three theaters are making efforts to combat the insurgencies. They are using their forces and confronting them. And so part of the number of fatalities we're seeing are also due to battle-related deaths.
Any recommendations to deal with the core reasons behind the rise in civilian fatalities due to violence in Africa?
There are many actions that are needed to defeat these insurgencies and protect civilians. I think given how well established and organized these militant Islamist groups are in these theaters and the expansiveness of the territories that they're covering, you're going to need to see concerted regional efforts to defeat them. I don't think any one national army is going to be able to do this on their own. It's going to have to be a collective effort. And this will help generate more troops to both go on the offensive against these militant groups, while also holding territory and protecting civilians in areas that you control. And this is something that the security forces in each of these theaters have had a hard time doing. Naturally, you know, this has to go hand in hand with greater oversight of the security forces to curb the human rights abuses and fatalities caused by the security forces against civilians, and which alienate the population against support for the authorities in these countries. Finally, I would draw attention again to the importance of a whole of government approach. The civilian side is as important as the security side. You need to be building trust with local communities to gain their trust and cooperation in fighting the militant groups. And all of these insurgencies, they are not popular among local populations, but communities are afraid of them. And so the authorities need to be working with communities and earning their trust so that they can collectively push back on the insurgents. This requires protecting civilians. It will require helping to invest in some basic services and help these communities have a vision that things will be better with cooperation with the government and counter some of the narratives that the insurgents are putting out about the government's just being corrupt and against local communities. I think this is especially important in the Sahel. We do need to see an accelerated transition back to civilian rule in these places as part of being more effective in defeating the insurgencies. The militaries can then focus on their job of fighting the insurgents and defending the communities, and then civilians can do more of the whole of government efforts of providing services, rebuilding economies, rebuilding coalitions with regional and international actors, and creating an environment that can attract investment that's going to help rebuild the economies that are going to really be able to sustain the fight against the insurgents.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. The Vatican says Pope Francis had another good night at Rome's Gemelli Hospital and continues to rest as his condition remains critical but stable while receiving treatment for double pneumonia. The head of the Catholic Church in South Sudan, Cardinal Stephen Amiyu, says Pope Francis is a friend of South Sudan. He tells VOA's John Tanza that Christians across the country are praying for the pontiff's quick recovery.
As we heard about his sickness, in fact, we had prayed for His Holiness that he may recover soon. We continue to join all the Catholics and the Christians all over the world praying for his health at this critical moment. And we believe that if God continues to preserve him for us, he will be always an important person for us, especially in South Sudan. The Holy Father loves South Sudan so greatly that even in spite of his condition of health, on being on the wheelchair, he came to South Sudan.
You have been very close to him, and during his visit to South Sudan, we saw several pictures of you and Pope Francis. What are some of the memories of your connection with him? Share with us some of the memories.
Indeed, the Holy Father has been personally connected with me as I became the Archbishop of Juba because of the difficulties in accession. So he became close to me to support me in those difficult moments. And that is how we built our relationship. And in fact, when I became Archbishop of Juba, there was this important connection that we had, and that led to his papal visit, ecumenical visit to South Sudan.
Apart from that, he also, in his own state of humility, he kissed the feet of South Sudanese leaders during their visit to Rome. And, you know, the situation in South Sudan is still unpredictable. In the backdrop of his humility to the South Sudanese people, what do you have to tell the leaders of this country?
Yes, Tanza, I know that had gone in history that the Holy Father kissed the legs of our leaders of South Sudan because he wanted that South Sudanese should come together as brothers, as people who have the same destiny. This was to encourage the president and the vice president to really put their hands together so that they bring a lasting peace to South Sudan.
Increased attacks and fighting have forced Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, to stop providing medical assistance in the huge Zamzam camp for displaced persons near Al Fasher in Sudan's North Darfur region. Despite widespread starvation and immense humanitarian needs, Marion Ramstein, project coordinator in North Darfur for MSF, spoke with VOA's Carol Van Damme about the decision to shutter its operations. The World Food Programme also halted food distributions there today.
The situation has been worsening for months, and the team have been trying its utmost to continue the activity no matter what. But we reached to a point that it was not possible anymore because of security, because of lack of supply, because of lack of adequate response. And we didn't have the means to treat the people in a proper way. So we had to take this really difficult decision. And beginning of December 2024, the shelling starts in Zamzam, which was a major escalation in the conflict because so far the IDP camps was a kind of spare.
Did you say in December the shelling started in the camp?
Yeah, in Zamzam. So before that, for months, there was offensive in El Fasher, which is 20 kilometers north than Zamzam. But Zamzam was kind of spared. So the shelling starts in December, quite close to one of our OPD outpatient departments. So we first had early December to stop one part of our activity, including one of our nutrition programs, which have already a huge impact on Zamzam because access to food and nutrition, especially for the children, is really a high needs.
Zamzam is a huge camp, like you said, 500,000 people. What are these people going to do to receive any kind of health care, especially emergency health assistance, when you leave? Because I don't know if there's anybody else who's helping to take care of them.
No, honestly, since we left, so the suspension of the decision was really based on the fact that we were not able to refer because our ambulance had been shooted at. So it was like a kind of humanitarian dilemma every time we need to send some people. Like, should we really send the ambulance and take the risk of someone to be dead on the road to save a life? So it was impossible to work. So that's why the decision was so complicated. It's because we know that because of the shelling, because of the attack, the health condition, for there were so many injured during the last day of our activities. We received so many injured, but still we had to shut down, knowing that there was no other actor to take over.
Why is the camp being shelled? Are there men in the camp that have weapons?
No, actually, it's something we can easily see by the way it has been attacked. The first attack was from the north, and then a few days later it was from the south, and RSF managed to get inside the camp quite easily, if I can say. And the camp was only protected by youth of Zamzam and some volunteers. On the 12th and the 13th, then some reinforced from a troop of SAF and joint forces came. But the camp was actually taken really easily because it was not really prepared for any attack and there is not a high presence of military. But
so are they going after it for the food and the water, or what are they doing?
But so far, they were feeling kind of safe inside Zamzam, but the access to food and water was really a challenge. There is some farms areas around Zamzam, so most of the people were going to the farm during the day to try to have some culture there. But most of the people are actually trapped, especially since the recent week, which with the deterioration of the situation and the intensification of the conflict, all the areas surrounded El Fasher and Zamzam were under attack. That's why we saw before the attack of Zamzam, early February, a massive arrival of new IDPs coming inside Zamzam, because the Shagra area, which is located northwest of Zamzam, have been burned down and looted and attacked by RSF.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.